And today I've invited Alexander Zacka, founder of Optionada. And Alexander is Austrian by birth and is doing his company in Berlin. So as you know, we try to bring you an international perspective, and today we have with us Alexander, who's going to bring us a very interesting perspective on what's happening in Berlin and in Europe in general, as well as a very unique and exciting company, what he's doing with Optionada in the domain of Web 3.0 and e-commerce. Welcome, Alexander. It's a real pleasure to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the invitation.
You're most welcome. So, Alexander, I will, what has piqued my curiosity all along, ever since we first spoke some time ago, it's been probably a couple of years now that we have been following what you're doing. It's just fascinating what you've been able to do. So let's kind of introduce our audience to the thought process behind Optionada. You know, and some of you who in the audience also have been following my writings around Web 3.0, as you know, my vision of Web 3.0 is captured in a very simple equation, Web 3.0 equal to 4C plus P plus VS. The four C's are content, community, commerce, and context. P is personalization. VS is vertical search. So in my opinion, Optionada is the quintessential Web 3.0 venture according to this definition. It makes use of all the different aspects of, bringing a web user experience to bear in the context of high-end auctions. So Optionada is a competitor to auction houses like Christie's and Sotheby's. Tell us more about what you do, how you do it, and the essence of Optionada, Alexander.
Yes, absolutely. I think the fundamental difference in your equation is that the way you actually group the four C's, I would do it a bit differently. It's obviously the equation works either way, but I typically start with commerce. So, and the commerce aspect, I think, is fundamental to what we have built at Optionada. It has always been a primarily focus of our business, business model, obviously, but also about the fundamental strategy of the company and the way it was laid out from beginning. Because auctions are always about commerce, and everything else has basically to serve the aspect of commerce. And this is where the other three C's come in. That's content, community, and context. The context, I think, is the first key step that unfortunately many other have missed, and that is that the original concept of the auction as it was invented 400 years ago has to be put in context with current 21st century commerce requirements of the audience that is being served. And so for us, it was always key to build the business within that specific context and to never leave that path. So what we built is a live stream auction channel, if you will, where we basically have auctions that we broadcast to a global audience with a large variety of auction products, which are cars, watches, wine, jewelry, paintings, design, basically name it, you get it. And the next one, obviously, is the community, because an auction, we all know, doesn't work if you have only one bidder, because then it's actually a buy now transaction. And once you have two people, you're already talking about a community. And so the big question in developing Optionada was always about how do we actually incentivize and emotionalize our community so they get engaged in a situation in a live situation where they're about to, fight against each other to win a certain item. You could argue that's not necessarily a beautiful thing. I've been told most people enjoy the situation, but I think it's a question how you address it. And that has been the third major focus when we built the company. And the last one then is actually the content. The content is maybe not even the most important, but certainly the most difficult to achieve, because you need to have the first three in place in order to build content, in order to acquire auction goods that are desirable for the audience. Most people forget that anything we build would not work without that content. And we always make a little bit of fun of people who call this content, because the word content hides a little bit the difficulty in actually building it. It's so much more difficult than anything else. But as in any equation, it doesn't work without one of its components, and this is why you got the four C's. So this has indeed been the focus of the company. Now, personalization is something that we just started to focus on. Fundamentally, personalization does not only mean that the curation, the expertise, the product is personalized. It fundamentally also means that the user experience is personalized to some extent. And this is where it gets really tricky, because the more the inventory grows, the larger the content, the lesser people are willing to, or the more actually people expect us to personalize their search experience and personalize their interaction, which is difficult because in a growing company, you'll always struggle with the number of entities and ever-changing managers in the company who deal with customers. And so at the end, you even want to go to the point that you personalize the contact experience that the customer has with the company. And that obviously is a long way to go, but we have seen that some very large companies, my favorite example is always Amazon, have been extremely successful in personalizing user experience. And so this is definitely
Alexander, on that one, I'd like to interject for a minute. And, you know, one of the things you shared with me when we talked earlier is that you offer personalized valuations even when people, to sellers who have, you know, art or whatever it is that they're trying to consider selling. Not even, they haven't even decided they want to sell yet, but they put a picture and descriptions of what they have, and your valuation expert, the community of valuation experts, then take that information and provide them with some sort of a valuation estimate, even if they have not placed the object or item on auction on your site yet. To me, that is a personalized user experience, absolutely, right?
It is absolutely, and we've actually even personalized it further through the process. We call it the sourcing funnel, because there are now all types of predefined interactions that the seller or the person that requests a free appraisal, which, as you remember correctly, does not mean that the item has to be sold to auction other. We have these people today also interact with our experts to even more personalize the experience and the reliability of the valuation. Now, we have to understand that the more we scale this, the bigger is the risk of inaccuracy and also lack of personalization. This is why it's so tricky, because at the end of the day, the number of valuation is about 100x versus 2 years ago today. And and it's still a very personalized experience, meaning that you get a 100% individualized statement. There's no, we never use standard, text elements or whatever for appraisals, because it doesn't make sense. because this would give you the feeling that there may not be any reliability to it if it's too, you know, if it's standardized. People believe in it and reliability because of the personalized aspect to it. And so scaling this is obviously tricky. You're using now also mobile crowdsourcing technology to some extent and in some categories, still in very early prototype mode, but it's being pursued because we believe that the personalization at the end of the day can only be scalable if a number of steps in the sourcing funnel or evaluation funnel, if you will, are followed in a manner that we deliver a very highly accurate, personalized, free evaluation to anybody who requests it. That is a lot of work, obviously. And the last one you have is vertical search. I think that this one speaks for itself. Given that we are now launching new categories literally on a monthly basis, last one we launched was antique garden furniture, not exactly a big category, but did very well in the start. It's very popular. And when we talk about creating a live stream auction channel, the idea is about covering as many auction categories as possible so that users think of us as a reliable source for, let's call it, unusual goods of all kinds, rare items, collectibles, obviously, art, a luxury, vintage luxury items, anything that people think of when they think of auctions. And obviously vertical search within that context is extremely important.
So, you know, one thing that struck me when I first learned about your story is that this is your first venture, and you have raised a substantial amount of venture capital for the venture, and part of the trick of that has been your immense domain knowledge in the business. So tell us a bit about where that domain knowledge comes from. How is it that you were able to convince VCs to fund this company as a first-time entrepreneur from Berlin? What's the source of the domain knowledge?
Well, I think the one thing that's, you know, that's ticked with me when I read your last book and another one that I actually got from a friend, that is that most entrepreneurs have a similar journey, and that is fundamentally it's very hard to raise the very first round. And then raising further rounds depends on your performance. But the first round, typically you do not have much performance to show, so people have to believe in your vision. And that is what makes it so difficult. Obviously, the follow-up rounds, we have always performed very well. This is why in all rounds, all existing investors have always reinvested, which doesn't happen too often. The first round, I think, had a lot to do with the fact that VCs typically bet on three things. One is whether there is a market that they think will be disrupted at some point. Second one is obviously the size of that very market, and the third one is whether the founders have an expertise in that specific market. They believe that if the company is well-funded and well-led, that everything else can be built around those three basic components, but without any of them, the company doesn't have a chance to function. So. And that was the case here. Obviously, we're looking at an industry that's not been disrupted in a long, long time. And at the time, I brought in over 25 years of experience in the auction world because I learned the business at the major auction houses, then found my own auction, worked long time for and with eBay while I was also running the family business at the same time. So I got a pretty good idea about how the auction market works, but what is even more important, I got a good idea what people expect from an auction, and also I have had an early understanding of how the internet might actually impact this and how the auction may develop and the markets may develop as we are moving forward. And that turned out to be essential because the one thing that I can tell you today, I couldn't tell you why exactly we have seen the growth we have seen in the past 2 years, but I can tell you that the one thing we did right is that we always sticked to the way we built the business, and I'm referring to building a commerce business in the context of the live auction. If we would not have made that choice very early, and if we would have left that path, I could not believe that we would be anywhere near the growth we are seeing today.
So one of the fundamental assumptions in making this business work is that you are able to establish trust. Somehow or the other, the Auctionata brand has been able to establish a level of trust such that very high ticket transactions are taking place on your platform. How did you achieve that level of trust?
That is, the first part of my answer is it is very true. I think we discussed, I think trust was the first thing we ever discussed at Auctionata. Trust is the only thing we kept discussing all the way, and trust is certainly the most important thing for our business model, and trust is the answer I cannot give because I don't know how to build trust, frankly, besides the fact that we try to be as honest as we possibly can, meaning we created some rules. We said, you know, we'll never publish a sale result that is not real. We'll never, you know, communicate numbers that are not real. We never, you know, we make all our terms transparent. We make our contracts transparent. We make our team and staff transparent. We make our policies transparent. We try fundamentally when we have an auction with a sale result of only 10%, which is not good, we publish that on the website as well as our super great successes. They're all there. We feel that by doing so, we're not harmed. Many people came to us and said, sometimes you have only 20 people in the auction room when you do a small auction. Why do you show this number? I think, you know, numbers become only relevant if you show the real numbers, because I believe that people have a very strong instinct. They do not know, but in general, people know always the truth, and they can put real and fake numbers very well apart. And, you know, many people would not admit that they do an auction, which is sometimes successful, sometimes not. Sometimes we have 1,000 people in the room. Sometimes we have 20 people in the room. But the 1,000 people in the room become only true when you show the 20 as well, because then people understand that this is real and live transparency. And I think this is only part of the whole thing. At the end of the day, the whole concept is that we show the items that, you know, we have in our possession, we're selling on behalf of the sellers, we show the first names of the bidders and their locations and the bidding increments. So there's a lot of things to see, and we let the community make their judgment whether they believe what is real. Now, the interesting thing is that the growth we have seen at Auctionata is not only in sales and in consignments and in revenues, but it's also specifically in the average value of any item sold at Auctionata quarter over quarter. And when we started, that number was below 1,000 euro, and in this specific month we are seeing here, it's significantly over 10,000. So it means also that the people are willing to spend or to buy more valuable items at Auctionata than they did 2 years ago, and I think, or 2.5 years ago. And I think this has to do with the way how we built trust into our DNA and into our culture. I mean, it ends up at the end of the day, you know, when I write my emails, I always think that at some point some crazy hacker will all put them on Facebook, or I don't know. So I just always try to teach people to stay as close to transparency as they possibly can, because eventually it will show that the business is trustworthy, which is very, very hard to achieve.
I have to say, I think the notion of maintaining as much transparency as possible has worked for us as well at 1M1M. You know, every single roundtable like this we do are online, and you know, there are 265 recordings of our roundtables available on YouTube, and that kind of transparency has helped us also establish trust. So I think transparency is one of the ways you can establish trust. Now,
transparency is actually what made us become fans of the World Wide Web in the first place.
Yeah, true. Now, what kind of market share do you have in the auction business right now, and are you on the radar of a Christie's or Sotheby's? Is there awareness, and do they consider you a threat now? What are you experiencing?
You know, that I start with the threat. I don't think you would, you know, you would see a mosquito as a threat. Let alone you will not ignore it when it's anywhere near you. That is, I think, the story of Auctionada. We still have the size of a mosquito compared to Christie's, but they're not ignoring us anymore. I mean, you know, fundamentally, we are now in our second full year of business with our live stream auctions, and we'll be ending this first half year with close to 40 million US in revenues, and obviously we're much closer to our next near-term target of achieving over 100 million in revenues this year, which is obviously very fast growth. And I think at this point the major competitors can easily calculate how long it will take for us to become a threat for them. Now, here in Germany, with the revenues we have today, we are already the largest auction house in Germany by revenue, and one of the top five or top 10 in Europe. The largest auction house in Europe makes roughly 200 million. So within 12 months from now, we will, within 18 months from now, we will have this size. And so we are being taken very seriously by our immediate competitors. In some areas, we already can see the impact we have in Germany. One example is Chinese art, where we have come very close to the leading auction house in Germany in revenues, and I've already heard the rumors in the market where people are saying they underestimated us. What most traditional business people fail to understand is the essence of growth. We all know that when growth is in the DNA, beyond a certain age, when we get older, we have these situations where we meet old friends and their kids, and when we see the kids, we cannot believe how much they have grown in just a year or two. So we, as human beings, as a tendency, we always underestimate growth, and that is the case here. As opposed to that, I have always tried to stay under the radar as much as possible. This is why I like so much this type of interview, because this is tech-focused and Silicon Valley-focused, and no German auctioneer will ever listen to it. It's good for us. We try to stay under radar as much as we can. We just soberly communicate our numbers, but obviously you can only stay under the radar for a certain point, and we've seen that regionally our market share is being taken very serious.
So what are you expecting in terms of, you know, your business distribution? Right now, of course, Europe is very big, and it sounds like you have very good penetration in China because of your expertise in Chinese art. What's the distribution of your business between Europe, China? What are your plans for America, or what is the business in America now?
So we always have to separate when we talk about business that on the customer, on the buyer side, the distribution is already very global, meaning that actually the U.S. on the buyer side is our largest market. And that China is second, and then Europe is third, and in Europe it's the German-speaking region, more or less ex-equal with the UK, and then the rest of Europe, and in between you even have the Arab countries and Russia. So it's already a very, very global buyer base. But in order to build the buyer base, we would not need to go anywhere outside of Berlin. However, the sourcing business is a more local business, because the seller is expected to consign the item physically into one of our premises. And for this reason, we have launched the U.S. business and also regional locations in the United Kingdom, in Spain, in Italy, in Switzerland to facilitate physical consignments of auction goods. And we will keep expanding across Europe and also on the American West Coast. We are just spent about 6 months on building an expansion plan, a global expansion plan for the next 3 years, and that is going through our supervisory board in September and for execution starting in 2016. But then we will have also tangible and sustainable data coming from the performance of our European offices and also from the United States East Coast.
So based on the revenue numbers that you you described, you are very close to a unicorn valuation at this point, right? Have you raised a round recently that has put a valuation on the company?
One thing where we really lack transparency is actually the discussion about the valuation. We don't see a lot of value in that. What I can tell you, though, is that the answer is no. We are still very far away from unicorn valuation for a simple reason. It's because, as I mentioned, in all rounds, existing shareholders have always invested. And since the number of existing shareholders is much larger than the number of new shareholders, they have dominated the Series C round, and the employee stock option pool has always been in a non-dilution situation. So it means that the only reason to raise the bar for the valuation would have been the new investors, which contributed only about one-third of the last round. So we had the choice of pursuing a very high valuation or putting a very reasonable price tag and being able to choose from a large number of investors. And so at the last round, we had the Hearst group, which for us is extremely important due to its publication network across the United States, which helps us in our expansion in the United States. The same obviously accounts for a group, Arnault, who is the largest luxury group. So these prestige investors, if you want to call them prestige investors, typically use their prestige to negotiate strong discounts in their investments. And so this is something we have discussed at length. And at the end of the day, we said we'd rather go with investors who can really help us with our expansion in favor of evaluation. Now, we are still having this discussion because there is a possibility for us to IPO the business next year. We've been working a lot with the German Stock Exchange here in Frankfurt, which is, as you know, one of the leading stock exchanges in the world, actually the second largest. And we had a long meeting yesterday, a pitch series with 21 major funds, and there was an anonymous poll. And among some questions, one was which company the investors felt would be have the biggest chances to perform in the stock market next year. And Auctionata made first place in this poll. And I think one of the reasons is, a reasonable valuation. As always, you always have to choose how you position the company, and this is maybe one of the exceptions where we said we'd rather remain in the position to be affordable, and as opposed to that, we can choose who we want to have in our board and who not, and that has proven to be very helpful for our growth. However, I agree, given the fact that I think in the current month, the current quarter, actually, the company will be profitable, and I think it will remain profitable more or less until the end of the year. And given that season over season, the growth has been always constant 180%, if we would go with these numbers to the stock exchange next year, we'd likely achieve unicorn status.
Fantastic. Very mature strategy of how you've navigated the valuation waters. I see a lot of entrepreneurs making very stupid choices in, you know, getting to unicorn valuation, but without the fundamentals and, you know, terms right. But you have made very, very, very smart choices. Now, last question.
Mentioned, I'm a first-time entrepreneur, and so I did have no choice but to listen to my advisors, and that was the early-stage investors. And they have a lot of experience, and so we built this strategy, and I think that's the reason why we were successful.
Great. Now, what about doing this business from Berlin? What has been your experience? Was it easy, difficult, particularly advantageous, disadvantageous to do it from Berlin?
Well, I mean, at the end, there is three major startup hubs in Europe. One is Berlin, the other is London, and the third one is Tel Aviv. And then now, so this is, you know, looking back at 2011, now there are more, and the European startup ecosystem is growing fast. I think Berlin has a number of very strong advantages. The first one is that it is a fantastic city to live. It's attracting a lot of young people that love the city. The second one is it's very cheap. It's incredibly cheap. I think, you know, one day in the valley is like 1 month in Berlin, and that's, I think, it's not an exaggeration. I saw some leases in the Bay Area, and I was shocked because I have a large apartment. It's about 1,800 square feet, and I pay rent. My rent is 900 euros, so that's 1,000 US. I think that's what you pay for a closet in the valley, but per week, not per month. The third one is Berlin has a history in being a place where young people from all over Germany come that are, how should I say, non-mainstream people, people that, creative people. And we have been overwhelmed by the number of young people we hired and who have grown with the company from, you know, trainee positions to leadership positions within very little time. And we see this journey going on, and it's likely it's the most fascinating thing that I have ever seen anywhere where I worked. And I'm not sure whether this would be possible anywhere else, at least not in Germany or Austria. I think this is typical for Berlin, that you have these young people coming here and growing so fast into not only strong professionals, but even in some cases to young leaders. And that is, that's been amazing. I think this is what speaks most for Berlin.
Well, Alexander, you're doing some very important work for Europe's sake. Europe really needs businesses and business leaders like yourself to come out of the economic malaise. And from what you're describing, hopefully Berlin is creating a cauldron of such leaders for the future. And I wish you all the best. We will be following your company. I love what you're doing. It's great fun, and it's great to see that it's a fundamentally successful business. And I actually think that you're going to give Christie's and Sotheby's a run for their money in due course. Maybe another 5 years is going to be a really serious threat. So good luck, and thanks for coming.
And I think you will be there in 5 years to tell me where we stand. And I guess I will be there as well. So let's look forward to it. Thank you for the invitation, and I'll see you soon again.
Yes. Bye-bye.